Our kids have said to us since we've moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number 4 best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR. The Motor Racing Network. Work.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Hey, guys. Back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick.
Joe, I have a question for you.
Okay.
What's your favorite sea monster from the Bible?
How many are there? I mean, you've got to go Leviathan, right?
Yeah.
Is there another good sea monster? I guess there's the whale slash great fish that ate Jonah.
That's right. Yeah. So depending on how you interpret Leviathan, you could be talking about two whales.
Yeah.
Leviathan, for anyone who's not familiar, shows up in the book of Job. There's a lot of sort of poetic discussion of the Leviathan, such as, canst thou draw out Leviathan with a hook, or his tongue with a cord which thou lettest down?
I think the Leviathan of the book of Job is pretty clearly a fire-breathing dragon, right?
Yeah. But I can never really get away from the idea that it is some sort of hideous, gigantic sea monster.
Yeah.
At least a sea serpent, if not a whale of some sort. But that's just how I always look to it.
Well, I know a lot of times people try to explain some of the Leviathan and the behemoth as being some kind of interpretation on existing animals. Like, oh, maybe it was a whale, or maybe it was a saltwater crocodile or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Why not go with a fire-breathing dragon? You got a fire-breathing dragon on your plate and you're trying to say, no, 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 I don't want it.
Well, I also have to say, for behemoth, the other massive creature that's referenced in Job, I have pretty much always imagined some sort of Warhammer battle creature from the Warhammer tabletop game.
Uh-huh.
Some sort of big, like, armored, fiery demon monster, yeah.
But, of course, the question of why the Leviathan and the behemoth are invoked in the Book of Job goes sort of to the theology of the book, right? Because mm-hmm. they're in the scene where God shows up and God's like, hey, who's the boss? Is it you? No, it's me.
Yeah.
Because I can best even these top apex predators on the earth.
Yeah, primordial sea monsters or land monsters or what have you, I can take them out. You can't, so I'm kind of running the whole show here.
But it invokes the idea that there are some beasts on earth so powerful, so tip-top of the pyramid, that it would take a god to best them.
That's right. When we think of some of our top apex predators, we often invoke these ideas, right? Because, well, what do you think of when you think of an apex predator? Well, maybe your mind turns to a tiger, you know, tiger, tiger burning bright. You know, mm-hmm. You can't help but romanticize the power of this creature. Or perhaps you think of the great white shark.
I always think of the shark.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so powerful and intimidating. It just, it haunts our dreams. Or perhaps, it summons visions of the mighty T-Rex or perhaps the Spinosaurus if you want some prehistoric flavor, or really any of the various prehistoric land mammals that were particularly ferocious looking.
So what are the qualities that you associate with an apex predator, the predator at the tip top of the food chain?
Well, generally you think it's got to be bigger than us.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't actually have to be bigger than us, but it helps for us to pass that crown of apex predator over to it.
Yeah.
It needs to be a ferocious predator, obviously, and it needs to have no enemies, except for maybe us if we're particularly crafty. And generally, we are crafty enough to eradicate just about anything on this planet.
Come on, we're the enemy of everything.
Yeah.
It's always got us.
Yeah, we're really the only things that have a leg up in the battle against humans are the smaller creatures, such as, say, the mosquito or various bacteria.
Yeah, we're much more threatened by, say, armies of unstoppable parasites than we are by that single one powerful creature, that king or queen of the animal world.
Yeah, and part of that has to do with the fragile nature of the apex throne.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing about the mighty apex predator. Its rule is tentative. There's not only loneliness at the top, but fragility and peril.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, who knows how many great apex predators have perished throughout the evolutionary timeline. So many just massive, toothy, flesh terrors have just ultimately perished. And many of them lost to us due to the rarity of their fossils.
Yeah, that's exactly the problem, right? How many T-Rex fossils do you expect to find? Well, actually not that many because there would, each time you go a step up the food chain, there are going to be fewer individuals. And often, especially with land-dwelling animals, those fewer individuals are less likely to end up in a place where they're likely to get fossilized. So yeah, the top apex predators are underrepresented in the fossil record. Those are just the ones that leave good fossil traces. I mean, one of the greatest apex predators of all time, which we will be talking about in today's episode partially, is the great shark, the megalodon, which because it's, this mostly cartilaginous fish, it doesn't have a solid skeleton like so many other animals do. So you rarely even find all that extensive of a trace of it. You have to find its teeth and maybe little fragments of spinal pieces here and there. You don't find whole intact megalodons.
That's right. Meanwhile, of course, as we've discussed, the trilobites are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we think of giant, successful creatures that prey with impunity and have few, if any, enemies in the natural world, we can't help but think of the giant whales, the great whales, such as the blue whale, the finback whale, the sperm whale, the right whale, and the humpback whale.
Man, whales are such amazing creatures.
And they are.
We are going to be focusing on one particular whale today, but also predatory whales in general. But especially when you get into the larger whales, there's really nothing on Earth like them.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for instance, the blue whale is not only the largest creature on Earth today, it is the largest creature known to have ever existed.
Ever.
Yeah. Like, we're living the peak. You can't go back into prehistoric timelines and find a bigger blue whale because the blue whale is the upper limit, at least as far as we've experienced it thus far as a planet.
But that's not the only whale superlative.
That's right. For instance, the sperm whale has the largest brain ever to have existed on Earth.
Yeah, and that big brain is even there in the scientific name of the sperm whale, which is Physeter macrocephalus. Macrocephalus meaning big head. Now, I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that it's got the biggest brain ever, but another one is that, of course, it's got this giant bloated forehead full of the spermaceti organ and the big melon that's used in echolocation, which we'll get to in a minute. But let's focus on that brain. An adult sperm whale's brain is about 8,000 cubic centimeters on average. And if you compare that to the mean human brain, which is about 1,300 or 1,400 cubic centimeters, you'll see the difference. Like, this is a whale. And we think of ourselves as like, wow, we got the best, biggest brain on in the world. And of course, brain size is not directly correlated to intelligence as we would imagine intelligence. But we think of ourselves as like the brain beast. We are the brain animal. And sperm whales have a brain that is about 5 times bigger than ours. Now, one thing you might wonder is, okay, you've got a blue whale that's much bigger than a sperm whale, but it's got a smaller brain than a sperm whale. Why is that? What would that be due to? Well, I would hypothesize that might have to do with the different ways these animals make a living. So whales belong to the biological order Cetacea, along with dolphins and porpoises. And from there, whales are divided into two categories. You've got the baleen whales, like the blue whale and the humpback, and then you've got the toothed whales, like the orca or the killer whale and the sperm whales. So you might chalk up this brain difference to the difference in the general trend of encephalization ratios for active or raptorial predators versus more passive feeders. Blue whales are filter feeders. I guess you could still say they're predators in a way. They prey on microscopic organisms, small organisms like krill and copepods swimming through these clouds of tiny crustaceans in the sea with their mouths open.
Yeah, they're buffet feasters, if you will.
Yeah. Well, another way to think of it is that they're grazers, right?
Yeah.
They're not herbivores. They're not eating plants. They are eating animals, but they're grazing on these vast patches of tiny animals that have no defensive capabilities or anything like that. They're just sort of drifting through their food.
Yeah, their whole approach is essentially, I'm just going to float around, eat as much as I possibly can, and I'm too big for anything to mess with me.
Yeah, and it's kind of beautiful, actually. There are videos of blue whales approaching these patches of their food sources, like krill and stuff. So you'll see a large cloud of just differently colored water, essentially. Mm-hmm. And the blue whales accelerate toward it. And right as they get toward there, they just pry their mouths open. It looks like a giant machine opening up to like accept a conveyor belt or something, which in a way it kind of is.
Mm-hmm.
And you've just got this massive flow in of these tiny organisms to get caught in its baleen plates, the mouth parts that catch the food so they can process it.
Yeah. And I don't want to imply that there's not an intelligence and a beauty and a strategy to the feeding practices of the baleen whales.
Yeah.
Because you do find examples of, say, humpback whales employing a sort of social strategy sometimes to consume their prey.
Right. But sperm whales, on the other hand, are more active hunters. So they often dive deep to catch their prey, which is mostly giant squid, but they also hunt fish and octopus and larger crustaceans and sometimes even sharks.
Mm-hmm.
So all around the world, I mentioned this encephalization quotient, all around the world, it's a pretty common rule that predatory hunters tend to have larger brains than the prey they hunt. And this implies a great need for processing power, not necessarily what we would think of as intelligence and the kind of abstract human intelligence that we associate with, I don't know, math problems or spatial problem solving or IQ tests or anything. I think biologists tend to think that sperm whales likely need these big brains for perception, which is a kind of intelligence on its own, right? Generally on land, a predator needs to have sharp senses to help it like track and spy on prey, you know, to sense prey from far away, to stay on top of it, to be very aware of its surroundings. And on land, this is very often sight and smell. But sperm whales, on the other hand, hunt mostly in this dark world of sound, hunting and mapping its surroundings by echolocation, where it uses these organs in its head to slap tissues together and create these clicks that are then reflected out into the water, and it listens for the echoes of these clicks reflecting back to it off of anything that has a different density than the water itself. So you have to, if you're trying to imagine the inner life of a sperm whale, imagine yourself as a creature with a huge, powerful brain so highly tuned for sound that their internal picture of the world around them in a totally dark place is as rich and fine-grained based on sound as our picture of the world is based on light. It's kind of impossible to put yourself in that headspace, but
yeah. And then, I mean, it also almost impossible for us as humans to imagine that this creature, its ancient ancestor was some sort of a land wolf.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's one of the craziest things is that you've always got to remember with whales, these creatures were not always in the water. They evolved from land-dwelling mammals.
Mm-hmm.
So you might wonder, once you're one of the larger whales, do you really have any enemies to worry about at all? Like if you are a sperm whale, if you're one of these powerful dark world predators that's, you know, got the biggest brain in the entire animal kingdom, one of the biggest bodies in the entire animal kingdom, is there any enemy out there for you? In the wild, not really, probably only orcas, really, the
right.
Orca or the killer whale. But orcas are also fascinating whale predators. I was reading a 2017 article in The Guardian by a marine biologist named Lawrence Smith about how orcas will sometimes attack great white sharks to eat their livers.
Oh, have
you ever
wonderful.
Heard about
no,
this?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's amazing. So apparently shark livers are just like jackpot marine nutrition. They're packed with more than 93% lipids, triacylglycerols. And Smith compares a great white shark liver to, quote, a deep-fried Mars bar with added vitamins. So wow. It's packed with fat, richly nutritious, but also lots of hard-to-come-by nutrients in the ocean. So how do you get a great white shark's liver, right? A great white shark, that's a rough customer, right?
Yeah, I mean, even as delightful as that liver is going to be, you're going to have to get through the great white and all those teeth to have a bite of it.
But apparently orcas don't have all that hard a time at it because orcas are highly evolved, incredibly adept apex predators, and they can even prey on other apex predators like sharks.
Yeah, they are pack hunters.
Yeah. And so the trick, Lauren Smith explains in this fascinating article, is that you give the shark the old flip-flop. So she writes, quote, during a 1997 encounter off the Farallon Islands off the coast of San Francisco, a group of whale watchers witnessed an orca ramming into the side of a great white shark, momentarily stunning it and allowing the orca to flip it over and holding it in place, ventral belly up, for around 15 minutes, after which the orca began consuming its prey, much to the surprise of the whale watchers on board. A similar incident was captured on film off Costa Rica in 2014. This time, the orca's prey was a tiger shark. And it's not just sharks. Orcas have been observed doing the same to stingrays, too. So what's going on here? Like, how come an orca can ram a shark, flip it upside down, and then just eat its liver with impunity? Well, apparently sharks and rays have a nervous system security backdoor, and it's known as tonic immobility. And this is a state of paralysis that elasmobranchs, which are sharks, rays, and skates, fall into when they get positioned upside down in the water. So you flip a shark belly up, ventral side up, and it'll go catatonic and lose muscle control. Basically just goes into a coma until it can get flipped around again. So what's the adaptive value in this? You got to wonder why a shark would have an exploit like this. Nobody knows for sure, but it has been suggested this might somehow be used in mating practices.
Oh, okay. Well, that would make sense. That would be like the one time where it might be important for a shark, a highly aggressive predator, to be at least mildly incapacitated by its mating shark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all this to illustrate how orcas are these amazing whale predators themselves. So do they pose any threat to sperm whales? Well, pods of orcas will sometimes attempt to separate sperm whale calves from their mothers and eat them. And I actually did find one account from a paper published in Marine Mammal Science in 2006 about a large herd of orcas attacking a pod of 9 sperm whales, including sperm whale adults, and preying on them. And
oh, wow.
It's actually kind of a horrifying scene they describe, where the sperm whales would circle up in this defensive posture where they kind of make a ring to defend themselves and try to fend off the killer whale attacks. But the orcas were coming at them, and it says that the orcas employed a wound and withdraw strategy. So they go in and try to injure the sperm whales and then back away, because of course a sperm whale is a very dangerous enemy, and you know, you could be seriously injured trying to prey on one. So yeah, there was at least this one account I found of killer whales preying on adult sperm whales, but generally it seems like sperm whales, once they're adults, they're in good health, they're pretty much unassailable in the ocean. They don't really have natural enemies except for the occasional large herd attack of killer whales, and then of course this one other enemy, this one.
And that would, of course, be humans, because we are and have been the main enemy of the great whales, certainly within the confines of human history, certainly in the last couple of hundred years.
Mm-hmm.
We're the apex hunters who hunted them relentlessly and drove several species to the brink of extinction. I mean, you compare us to the orcas, who, again, are mainly going to be a threat to young whales.
Yeah.
And there is certainly some heartbreaking documentary footage out there of orcas hunting a mother and her young whale across the seas.
Yeah.
But humans, in their whaling practice, just prey on everything.
Yeah. Though a counterpoint to that orca hunting is if you get to witness the protective practices of the adult, like the mother sperm whale, that's pretty amazing too.
Yes, but it depends on the documentary. There's some like if it's an Attenborough documentary, I don't necessarily trust that he is not going to break my heart with some terrifying predation.
Well, there's a lot of heartbreak in the ocean.
Yeah, I mean, there's no denying it. But basically, I end up approaching it this way because I watch a lot of documentaries with my son, and it's gotten to the point where it's kind of a toss-up, like how he's going to respond to the predation. Because used to, like any predation, especially if there was dramatic music, he would get a little upset about.
Yeah.
But now at almost 6 years old, he's surprisingly chill with some grotesque levels of predation. Like it'll be three leopard cubs feasting on a corpse. And I'll come in and I'll walk over and I'll see this. And I'll be like, "Ooh, are you okay with this, buddy?" And he says, "Oh, yeah, they're brothers. They're hungry." That's fine.
Robert, I think you've just come up with a great children's show, The Hungry Brothers.
It's all about how you frame it, right? Now, one of the questions that the flip-flop of all this is, do sperm whales ever attack humans?
This is something that has been a point of controversy, though there are definitely reports, especially reports from the 19th century of, for example, sperm whales ramming ships.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's hard to tell if these accounts are accurate, but sailors from like sunken ships in the 19th century did report sometimes, yes, what happened is a sperm whale rammed our ship until we sank. It like attacked us with the intent to kill us. And, you know, it's hard to imagine if that's even true to begin with. It's hard to imagine what's going on in the mind of the sperm whale. Though I have also read comments from some marine biologists who think, well, yeah, it's possible that, for example, a sperm whale might ram a ship if it perceived that ship as a threat, which a sperm whale could have good reasons to do, especially in the 19th century with horrible whaling practices. I mean, if you read about some of the whaling practices that were in place, then it's worse than any Attenborough documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just the most sadistic kind of methods. One I read about was where the whalers would kidnap a calf whale, injure it, and then keep it there injured, waiting for the parents to come and try to rescue it, at which point they'd harpoon the parents.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the individuals participating in this at the time, you do have to realize, yeah, they were participating in an industry, and this was probably not everyone's first choice.
It's true. I mean, I shouldn't judge too much. I mean, in some cases, this is also a cultural practice that I shouldn't pass too much judgment on that, but
certainly the whaling industry,
it's hard to think about.
Yeah, but certainly the whaling industry did become such an industry that it is difficult, if not impossible, to look back on it now and not feel a little sick about it.
Yeah.
Like when I was a kid in Newfoundland, Canada, for a while, I remember we would at least on one occasion we walked through an abandoned whaling port, and it was even then, when I only like really kind of partially understood everything, it was kind of haunting because you would find these like whale vertebrae, and then there would be these big rusted harpoons, like the blunt harpoons, and then as well as some of the pointed ones as well. And these were like the later day ones, the ones that would have been launched off of a cannon, I understand, not the romantic Moby Dick era harpoons.
I feel like there's another way in which whaling sort of violates our hunting intuitions, which is that, I mean, a lot of people would feel terrible about any kind of killing of an animal, but somehow there's an intuition that killing an animal to harvest its meat for food is kind of different than like killing an animal to melt it down and render its fat for industrial purposes, which is a lot of what was going on with whaling.
To light lamps, et cetera.
Yeah.
Now, as you mentioned earlier, a lot of these stories of like whales ramming ships, we're not completely sure what happened. There's a lot of legend that rises up surrounding the activity of whales during the height of the whaling industry. And then there are, of course, whole myths of sperm whales in particular swallowing humans whole.
Is that true? Did that really happen?
So I've looked into this in the past. Stuff to Blow Your Mind actually did an episode on this way back in the day. And it seems like it probably did not happen. Mm-hmm. It's an inviting idea because sperm whales, as we already mentioned, they do feed by suction. Some chewing, but oftentimes they're just sucking down something whole. In fact, in 1955, unchewed 405-pound giant squid was recovered from the belly of a sperm whale. And the sperm whale doesn't even have a tongue. you know, to prevent just this absolute inhalation
yeah.
of tissue. Now the question, of course, is has a sperm whale ever sucked down a human being?
Yeah.
Which is also probably an inviting idea because of the myth of Jonah and the whale.
Oh yeah.
Or stories like Pinocchio and the belly of a whale, or even modern retellings like the Whaler's Revenge song by the Decembrists. There's actually a wonderful article that came out in Salon back in 2012 by author Ben Shattuck. And he explored the question at the New Bedford Whaling Museum Research Library. So he was going through all these various accounts of whale-related deaths, frequently caused by whale-on-boat action.
And, so like we were talking about, like ramming a boat and sinking
yeah,
it.
Yeah, or just also thrashing, you know, like the fluke could hit the boat. I mean, these are massive creatures. And in their struggle to survive, yeah, they could do some serious damage to a boat.
Well, that's the thing to remember. If they want to kill us, of course they could. The question is, like, would that be something that would occur to them to do?
Right. So Shattuck says, quote, "I'd like to believe in swallowings, but it's tough. There is no air in the stomach, for one. There are acids. And if we are talking about sperm whales, which we are most of the time, there is the deadly passage through the 30-foot jaws and those 8-inch teeth." So this is a wonderful article, and I'm not going to attempt to summarize it all here. He gets into a number of different angles, and it really gets into the heart of this kind of like vor fetish, this idea that we kind of like the idea of being consumed whole by another organism because it is like a return to the womb.
How weird.
Yeah. So he discusses a few different stories, different accounts of people being dragged and released by whales, mauled by whales. There's one particular story, the case of Edmund Gardner, where there's actually a photograph of this individual years later, and you can still see his mangled hand because he lost some fingers to the mouth of a sperm whale.
Whoa.
There are ultimately in the New Bedford Whaling Museum thousands of accounts of people being chewed on by whales, but there's not a single one of someone being swallowed. Shattuck, however, not to disappoint, he does discuss what it would be like to be eaten by a sperm whale.
That is my kind of exploration.
Yeah.
Now, we did the what it would be like to get eaten by a giant spider. We could do a whole episode on what it would be like to get eaten by a giant whale.
Yeah, yeah. He goes into it in depth in the article, but basically it would go down like this. You'd be sort of chewed on or at least gnashed on by those 8-inch teeth. You get sucked down the throat into a dark, airless place, just water and acid, and then you'd slide into the first stomach or holding bag for 24 hours. Perhaps surrounded, he has this beautiful description of the possible bioluminescent squid that would be down there with you, lighting it up for a little bit. But then the acid would break you down and you'd pass through three smaller S-shaped stomachs, liquidized and then reduced to whale excrement with some possible bits of bone stuck in there. And that would be your journey.
Pooped out in a cloud of beaks.
Yes. Yeah, because that being the side fact here is that, of course, the beaks of giant squid are not digested either and they end up just passing through.
Rest in beaks. Okay, but today we want to look at these magnificent giant predators, the sperm whales and their predatory toothed whale relatives, and specifically to follow their ancestors back through history, millions of years back to the time of something that seems to me like maybe the ultimate predator, the best apex predator I've ever read about, the Leviathan. And I think we should tell the story of this creature when we come back from a break.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR. The Motor Racing Network.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
All right, we're back. So to be clear, we've known about prehistoric whales in general for quite a while now. And if you've ever spent much time in a paleontology museum or book, then you've seen these creatures often depicted as sort of Skeksy-faced whales, you know?
Now, you're not pronouncing sexy in a funny way. You're saying like Skeksis, yes. Like in the Dark Crystal.
Right. The Skeksis of the Dark Crystal, where they're kind of like long, slender, snouted, and very toothy looking.
Vulture-faced.
Yeah, kind of vulture-faced whales. That's how paleo artists tend to depict them. And the prime example here would be Basilosaurus.
Oh, I like the name.
Yeah. Well, its name is misleading because it means king lizard.
What? But it's not a lizard?
It's not a lizard. But due to the rules of naming, attempts to name it other things have not worked. So we're stuck with Basilosaurus.
Okay. Tell me about Basilosaurus.
Okay, so this was a genus of prehistoric cetaceans from the late Eocene. That's 40 to 35 million years ago. And according to the Smithsonian, they probably reached lengths of 40 to 65 feet. That's 12 to 20 meters, roughly. Though the 1988 Encyclopedia of Dinosaurs and Prehistoric Animals, that's a book that I grew up with and continue to check out with my son because it has all these wonderful illustrations.
Uh-huh.
That book boasted a length of up to 82 feet or 25 meters.
Oh, I can tell they're stretching it, right?
Yeah. Now, but if you want to talk about stretching it, you go back to 1845. Albert Koch, who was an avid fossil collector, showman, and proprietor of the St. Louis Museum, mm-hmm. he claimed that the creature would have measured 114 feet long or 35 meters.
Dang.
And yeah, he was a bit of a showman, but this drew skepticism from the scientific community even at the time. They were like, I don't know. That sounds a bit big.
I mean, there's always this inflationary tendency, right? You want to make the thing as big as possible.
Yeah, you're trying to sell tickets.
Yeah.
So this creature would have been an early precursor to the great toothed whales to follow, sharing a similar diet, but without the larger cranium size or the evolved social behavior. And this brings us to the Leviathan.
Right, the Leviathan. I'm so excited about the Leviathan. So I want to tell a fossil discovery story and give you the setting. Right?
Okay.
So it was November 2008, and there were a team of fossil hunters. They were exploring the desert of the Pisco Ica area of Peru. And this is a part of a long strip of desert that runs north-south along the western coast of South America, west of the Andes. So if you picture South America, you've got the west coast, and then there's usually desert regions stretching to the mountains of the Andes, and then you've got, you know, more lush rainforest or other types of ecoregions going east of the Andes. And the Pisco Ica region is south of the capital city of Lima in Peru, but north of the Nazca region, which is known for its amazing ancient geoglyphs carved in the earth. If you've never seen the Nazca geoglyphs, by the way, you should look them up. They're great. So there's a 2010 New York Times article about this area in general, and though the Times focuses on one region in this desert known as the Okukahe Desert, so you have to picture this apocalyptically dry dusty expanse, often totally desolate, very windy, stretching to the west-facing side of the Andes. And the winds here kick up dust devils, and they steadily erode these old jagged rocks. To get a sense of it from a local, the Times article quotes someone named Yolanda Gutierrez, who's a worker who travels into this region to harvest seaweed from along the coast in the desert. And Gutierrez says, quote, "This desert is horrible. The only things a person sees are dirt and rocks and bones." But what if you're looking for bones?
Well, then I'm guessing you're in for a treat.
Yeah. So the French paleontologist Christian de Muizon says that the desert along the coast of Peru contains what is probably, quote, the richest spot in the world for fossil marine mammals. And this New York Times article is interesting. It points out that this area is so rich in fossils, especially marine fossils, that local merchants in Ica and other nearby towns sell fossilized shark teeth the size of a man's hand for $60 to $100.
Oh, wow.
Now, the size of a man's hand, that's not a great white tooth. That's something else.
Yeah, that's getting into like megalodon territory. We're talking the beasts of old.
Right. So according to Peru's Ministry of Culture's Office of Recovery, in 2010 alone, there were more than 2,200 seizures of illegally obtained fossils that people were trying to smuggle out of the country or sell on the black market. So this is Fossil City.
Mm-hmm.
But especially for marine fossils. So there are many officially recognized fossil discoveries from the area, including the teeth of the megalodon, which is this giant prehistoric shark we've been mentioning that could grow 18 meters or 60 feet long. A 2008 study in the Journal of Zoology by lead author Stephen Rowe created a model that predicted this animal could have had a bite force of more than 180,000 newtons, which is about 40,000 pounds or about 18,000 kilograms of bite pressure. And this has been described as strong enough to crush a car.
Yes. Now, to put that in perspective with other species, the black piranha, 320 newtons of force.
Okay.
The largest saltwater crocs alive today. Day, 16,414 newtons.
Okay.
The largest great white sharks alive today, 18,216 newtons. Humans, 1,317.
But so this is 10 times stronger bite force than a great white shark.
Yes.
And a great white shark has amazingly strong bite force. So the megalodon was a beast. It could bite, bite your dreams in half. It could bite a chunk out of a mountain. This thing was the beast of beasts. And a kind of creepy fact to remember is that the megalodon existed until it seems like about 2.5 million years ago. That feels too close, right?
It does,
like,
yeah.
Like, what if you found out Tyrannosaurus rex had existed until around the same time as our Australopithecine ancestors?
Yeah, you would be more inclined to think, well, I might run into one.
Yeah.
And even though, to be clear, there are no megalodon left in the sea, it does feel a little too close. It makes you a little more inclined to think, well, maybe there could be, especially if the right sort of sci-fi novel scenario were met.
Yeah. So this western desert in Peru is a rich spot for ancient marine fossils because this desert was once a seafloor, which has been pushed up to become dry land by the tectonic activity that created the Andes, the mountains there. So when you walk through this desert, there are these little hills and rocky formations that very often contain fossilized creatures that swam the sea millions of years ago. And so according to Nature News in 2008, a member of this team of researchers I mentioned named Klaas Post, a Dutch researcher who worked at the Natural History Museum in Rotterdam, came across a rocky outcropping with a monstrous toothy figure embedded within it. It was a jaw fragment about as long as an adult human with these unbelievable teeth, teeth like artillery shells. And it was what appeared to be the fossilized skull of a giant whale, though it was positioned inside the rock, the skull was broken and upside down. And once the fossil was excavated and prepared in Lima, the researchers, including Christian de Muizon, who I quoted a minute ago, and Olivia Lambert, and others published their findings in Nature in 2010. This was no ordinary sperm whale. They figured out that they had discovered a new genus and species of extinct predatory whale related to sperm whales, and they named it Leviathan melvillii.
Ah, so that's wonderful because they're drawing on the biblical tale of Leviathan, and then they're also paying homage to Moby Dick.
Right, and so they cited Moby Dick as the reason for calling it that, more so than pointing to the Bible, because in Moby Dick, Melville very often refers to the great sperm whale as the Leviathan.
Right, and so here we have like the ultimate sperm whale, like the prehistoric sperm whale, a sperm whale so gigantic that it may have eaten whales.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a minute. And it's not – I want to emphasize that it's not necessarily its size, because the sperm whales of today are very large. Mm-hmm. It is something more about the mouth and the teeth and the face that we'll get into that explains what exactly this creature was. So their Nature paper was published under the title, quote, "The Giant Bite of a New Raptorial Sperm Whale from the Miocene Epoch of Peru." And the authors identified this specimen as having lived about 12 to 13 million years ago, which would have put it in the middle Miocene. Its head was 3 meters long, or about 10 feet. And extrapolating from this, the team concluded that the animal's body length was at least 13.5 meters, or 45 feet, and up to 17.5 meters, or almost 60 feet, putting it in the sperm whale or megalodon size category. And these teeth, unlike modern sperm whales, which just have the fully developed teeth on their lower jaws, Leviathan melvillii had interlocking teeth on its upper and lower jaws. And if you take one of these teeth and measure it, it is like a 2-liter soda bottle almost. I mean, it is huge. You'll find it's 36 centimeters long, or over 14 inches long, and 12 centimeters, or almost 5 inches in diameter. Insanely big teeth. These are, in the words of Christian de Moison, the biggest tetrapod bite ever discovered.
Now, I do have to add that nobody yet has crunched the numbers on exactly how many newtons this particular bite would pack.
Yeah.
But Lambert in particular estimates that it was probably either on par with Megalodon or perhaps exceeded Megalodon's bite. But it remains an open question.
But bigger teeth than the Megalodon, right?
Yeah.
I mean, these teeth are hilarious if you look at them. And if you try to imagine them in situation as they would have been in the mouth, and this mouth is coming at you open, it's the most terrifying thing you can think of.
They're almost too big for us to even process as teeth. They're like giant stalactites and stalagmites, you know?
Yeah, they look like sharp-ended dinosaur eggs. Mm-hmm. They're just gigantic. So what was the life and setting of this massive ancient hunter, the Leviathan, the killer whale of killer whales? How did it live? Well, first of all, 12 million years ago, predatory toothed whales were much more numerous than they are today. Today, when you think of predatory toothed whales, you've got things like the orcas, the mm-hmm. killer whales, and you've got the sperm whales that dive deep into the darkness and mostly prey on squid by this suction action. But something to keep in mind is that not all of the toothed whales today are, as we've been pointing out, biters. Mm-hmm. Modern sperm whales, they do this suction thing. They suck the squid in and swallow it. But the Leviathan, based on its jaw and its teeth, the paleontologists looking at it have said, oh yeah, this thing was definitely a biter. It was a raptorial predator that would swim up and it would bite something. And by looking at an animal's mouth parts, you can very often tell what kind of stuff it would have been biting, right?
Yeah, because as we've said before, nature is a cheapskate.
Right.
It's not going to keep teeth around for no reason. If the teeth are there, they're serving a purpose.
Yeah. If you're eating cucumber sandwiches, you don't need 36 centimeter long teeth and a bite force on the scale of the megalodon. So because of the shape, size, and wear pattern on the teeth and the skull, the authors of this study believe that Leviathan did not prey on smaller, softer prey like squid, but was hunting large prey with tough skeletons and hard body parts. That prey was very likely other whales, specifically mid-sized baleen whales, likely between about 7 and 10 meters long, meaning the prey animals of this whale were about 23 to 33 feet. This is the whale killer whale, the Wolf of Whale Street.
I love that. We're going to have to go with that for the title now of the episode.
Uh-huh.
All right. So at this point, I should really drive home the reign of the Basilosaurus that we discussed earlier was ancient history by the time Leviathan came to rule the seas. And as far as we know it, it pretty much ruled the seas. It was pretty much the top predator of the ocean.
We don't know of anything else out there to compete with it except maybe the Megalodon.
That's right. The only known creature from this time frame that would have rivaled it would have been Megalodon. But it's unknown if these two species ever actually competed against each other or certainly had any kind of like a throwdown epic sea monster battle. You know, I have to say it's interesting that some theorize that competition and threats from the likes of Megalodon may have led to the development of pack hunting behavior in toothed whales such as the orca.
Yeah.
And to the gigantic size of Leviathan. And of course, it's also argued that Leviathan's hunger may have led to an increase in size among the baleen whales, you know, get big enough to where you're no longer going to be as easy of a prey species for the apex predator.
Uh-huh.
And this may have led to the humpbacks and finbacks and the great blue whales that we know today. I do have to add, though, that more fossil evidence is needed to fully support this notion, though.
That's an interesting concept. I hadn't heard that, but that kind of makes sense that they would evolve to become larger in order to better defend themselves against these horrible ancient predators.
Or it just becomes you think about what sort of animals is the apex predator preying on?
Right.
You know, what sizes, what particular strains of the genome are falling to it? And then how is that affecting the surviving sizes among the species?
I mean, as an animal keeps getting bigger and stronger than you, it's harder and harder to prey on it, obviously.
Right. And even an apex predator is not going to say, I feel like a challenge. I'm going to go after this big boy here. No, you're going to go after what is easiest.
Of course they don't want challenges. I mean, again, nature is a cheapskate and animals are cheapskates. They don't want to take unnecessary risks. I mean, this goes back to this question you brought up. Everybody always wants to know once they find out about Leviathan Melville, did the Leviathan and the Megalodon fight?
Mm-hmm.
Who would have won in a fight? And I am, of course, not above a little bit of fantasy monster showdown thinking myself. But from what I've read, there's probably not a good reason to think that the adults of these species would have fought one another. They might have like tried to prey on the young of the other species.
Mm-hmm.
But once they're adults in good health, these are both very large and very powerful predators. And for either one to start some trouble would have been a risky move, right? Remember, actual fighting is rarer than you probably imagine in the wild. Animals don't like getting hurt. And when they pick on something their own size and strength or bigger, they are likely to get hurt. And animals are much more likely to go after smaller, weaker prey. That, you know, when you see predators attacking a herd of antelope or something like that, they're very often trying to get the young or trying to get a sick, weakened animal, not to get a strong animal in its prime that might kick them in the face.
Though I do hear that Megalodon liver is just delicious.
Well, I want to come back to that in a minute. So though Olivia Lambert has suggested that these species may have tried to pick off one another's young, I haven't come across any evidence that there are fossil records of them fighting one another as adults, and it doesn't seem like it would have made a lot of sense for them to do that.
Only humans really are stupid enough to go after the impossible dream, you know, to sort of, and we idolize it too. We look at someone like, say, Werner Herzog, and we say, you know, in his decision, I want to film the movie about dragging a boat over a mountain.
Yeah.
And we're going to actually drag a boat over a mountain to do it. Megalodon is not going to do that. Neither is Leviathan.
That's human folly.
Yeah.
So here's another curious observation. We talked earlier about the gigantic foreheads of sperm whales. These big heads contain what's known as the spermaceti organ, right, which is a collection of these chambers holding oily, waxy material. And it's not known for sure exactly what this is for, but there are a couple of main hypotheses that have been put forward over the years to explain it. The first, that it has been used in echolocation. And from what I understand, I think this is the favored hypothesis now. But a second that has been put forward is that the spermaceti organ was an aid in regulating buoyancy to help the whale in managing its deep dives. So Leviathan also appears to have had a spermaceti organ in its head. But if there's any truth to the second hypothesis, you might wonder, why a whale like Leviathan would need something like that, right? Because the hypothesis of Leviathan's life is that it didn't need to go down and deep dive for squid, that it was a shallow feeder. It was a shallow hunter like these other predatory whales. Now, one kind of crazy hypothesis to explain what's going on here has been leveled at this from the University of Utah evolutionary morphologist David Carrier, who we've mentioned on the show before. I think, was he the fist punch theory guy?
Oh my goodness, I think he was.
Yeah, so he said, quote, spermaceti organs could be used as battering rams to injure opponents during contests over females, or I think he also mentions it could have been used to incapacitate, immobilize prey. So Carrier cites the fact that, as we mentioned earlier, people have told these stories from the 19th century that their boats were sunk after being rammed by sperm whales. So it's being imagined for this ancient predator here, the giant toothy whale, the biter, Leviathan, is that you've got a 1-2 punch. The world's largest marine predator speeds out of the darkness, smashes into you at full speed, knocks you senseless, and then just bites you in half with teeth the size of 2-liter soda bottles.
Oh, wow. Just surging up from the depths. I like it.
Now, who knows if this is correct, but there's another way, actually, in which this ramming theory does seem kind of plausible to me, because the Leviathan is more often cited as a relative of the sperm whale due to its mouth structure and possible hunting patterns. But it might be helpful to imagine what would happen if you basically had a gigantic orca, a killer whale the size of a sperm whale. Remember the story from earlier about how orcas got the shark liver?
That's right. They needed to hit them in the belly, right?
Right. So the orca would ram the shark to stun it and immobilize it, then flip the shark on its back, which would send it into this catatonic state, the tonic immobility, where it would go into a frozen paralysis, and then the orca could dine on its liver at its leisure. And so now I'm imagining this exact thing, but instead of an orca and a great white, it's a Leviathan and a megalodon. 12 million years ago.
Yeah, because while there's certainly a sort of a prey hacking tactic involved with using it against sharks, it would probably work pretty well against a whale too.
Yeah.
A monster like this just ramming into its prey.
Now, of course, this is just a hypothetical scenario I'm imagining. Once again, there is no direct evidence I'm aware of that the Leviathan ever preyed on adult megalodon, but it is fun to imagine, isn't it?
Yeah, we can't help but imagine these ancient battles. I just read an entire book to my son where each page, each spread was one dinosaur against one prehistoric beast.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to compare stats to see which one would win.
Oh.
And we did spend a lot of time explaining, well, these two would never actually battle. You know,
right.
They would have never met. And if they had, why would they have messed with each other?
Right.
But we still love a good teardown fight.
Well, if it came down to it, the megalodon is no slouch. But one thing you got to remember, the Leviathan's got bigger teeth and a bigger brain.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to have to show my mammalian bias and root for the Leviathan no matter what. Like, I just feel more of a kinship to the Leviathan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you've got to. That shark's got black eyes like a doll's eyes.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get to another pressing question. Where'd all these monsters go?
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air, and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes. Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR. The Motor Racing Network. Work.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured. Not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
All right, we're back.
So, Robert, I want to come back to this thing we discussed at the beginning about the apex predator and how it seems in our mind versus how it is in reality. Because apex predators seem so individually powerful, the tiger, the great white shark, or even the ancient megalodon or the leviathan. It's difficult for us to imagine how a beast this powerful would disappear, would ever have any kind of vulnerability or go extinct. Like, what could wipe them out? What could pose a challenge to them? They were top of the pops, right?
Yeah.
But while individually strong, apex predators are just as vulnerable to extinction as any other species, and in many cases, actually much more so.
That's right, because your species may become king whale, but it doesn't mean that you're going to remain king whale. Because what will happen to thy prey, O great eater?
Right, yeah.
Will you eat them all, and in doing so, seal your own extinction with theirs? Or will you eat the ones that you can easily catch, and in doing so, encourage traits in your prey that will one day outwit you?
Or encourage specificity and laziness in yourself.
That's right. Yeah. You become dependent on this one thing. You become great at this one type of predation. Mm-hmm. So you eat only the small. And so the species grows larger with time because larger specimens are more likely to evade your bite. Meanwhile, those who compete with you for your prey adapt with time as well, perhaps growing larger or craftier. The smaller predators become pack hunters, perhaps using their tactics against you and your own precious young, again, a strategy employed by varieties of orca to this day.
Yeah, and there is a lot of evidence that social behaviors tend to win out over time.
Yeah. So I have a fun example I'm going to throw out here. So I just ask everyone to roll with me on this. But let's consider Jason Voorhees as a sort of apex predator, right?
Okay. Is he more the megalodon or the leviathan? He's maybe more megalodon, right?
I think more megalodon. He has more of that like shark brain going on, I think.
Uh-huh.
So for whatever silly reason, he's very adept at preying on promiscuous or otherwise morally suspect teenagers.
Right. He hears that beer can cracking from far away and he's on the march.
But it's the solid moral characters who prove difficult prey, as well as the, of course, psychically potent teenagers as well.
Okay, so you're invoking the rules of horror and slasher movies, which are that the good kids tend to be the only ones who can outwit the killer.
Right. But then the added rule for Jason, if there's a kid with psychic powers, that one's going to be difficult prey as well.
Well, the kid with psychic powers tends to be the good kid.
Yeah, true. So over time, perhaps Voorhees' predatory habits advanced the genetic tendency of moral and psychic prey until his natural habitat of Crystal Lake is just overflowing with psychic virgin honor students that best him at every turn.
Okay.
Or maybe he's just so good at his job that slashers with less robust franchises, like, say, Leatherface,
okay,
they have to become more social or intelligent in order to earn their kills.
So Leatherface has a whole family helping him out.
Exactly. It kind of writes itself, doesn't it?
Robert, you've taken this into profound territory.
Now, speaking of species becoming smarter and having better brains, better social abilities to mm-hmm. compete, we touched on the encephalization quotient earlier. That's the EQ. And this is, to be clear, the actual brain size of a creature versus what would be expected on mass alone.
Yeah. Now, often this is taken as a measure of the intelligence of an animal. And there does appear to be some correlation, but it's not a totally direct mm-hmm. correlation. There are outliers with bigger or smaller brains relative to their bodies that don't seem to be totally in line with how intelligent we think they are.
Yeah. So the pack hunting orcas, they boast a 2.5.
Okay.
Now that's small compared to the human 7, or the bottlenose dolphins 4, but it rises above the baleen whales 1.
Yeah.
They boast the processing powers necessary to hunt as a social unit.
Well, yeah. I mean, the baleen whales, they probably don't need much more of a brain than like a grazing herbivore would need.
Yeah. Now, it's also possible that environmental factors contributed to the downfall of the Leviathan. A cooling climate during the late Miocene, around 10 million to 11 million years ago. Mm-hmm. Giant active predators simply wouldn't be able to function anymore. Meanwhile, smaller predators could have fared better, including sperm whales that depended on deep sea prey like the giant squid.
Now, why would they do better?
Well, because you have the deep, dark, cold ocean. This is a more of a stable environment.
Ah, okay. You know,
less vulnerable to climate change. So
there's climate change on the surface that's affecting what prey are available, but you know you can always go down into the dark world to get you some squid.
Right. The squid remain constant down there. So those that can dive down and eat that meal, they have a stability that the whale eaters are just not going to have.
Yeah, it's fascinating to contemplate what happens to these powerful creatures like the Megalodon and the Leviathan. We've got these different theories about what happened to them, but ultimately a lot of things could have happened to them, because even though the individual apex predator is strong, the apex predator as a species depends on an awful lot going right in order for it to survive. It has to have access to its prey. If the prey thins out, dies off, or migrates somewhere else, the apex predator can starve. Apex predators also tend to have low reproduction rates and large bodies with powerful brains and muscles, which need lots and lots of food to grow and sustain. The apex predator business, you might say, in some ways is a very successful one, but it's also a high initial investment organism that requires a lot of incoming cash flow in the sense of a business, right? If you can't keep the flow of resources streaming to it, it quite quickly gets into desperate circumstances. It can't feed itself, can't reproduce and raise healthy young, or in some cases might even turn to cannibalism, which is not good for a species in the long run. The genetic economics of cannibalism do not pay off. Now, some sort of apex predators have managed to survive many ecological crises and just keep going, right? Like sharks are a good example. The megalodon isn't still around, but sharks in general have been pretty top of the food chain predators for more than 400 million years. But of course, the megalodon still extinct, and the deep diving squid sucking sperm whale still exists, but the Leviathan is now extinct. So where do these giant apex predators come from in the first place? That might kind of help us explain where they go. Well, one thing is that there's this informal principle in evolutionary biology known as Cope's Rule, named after an American paleontologist named Edward Drinker Cope.
Where are all the drinkers today?
I don't know.
I don't run across that name very often.
Cope's Rule states that over geological time, a lineage of related animals will tend to increase in body size. And this is an informal rule because it doesn't always hold at every taxonomic level or every type of organism, but it is very often true. It's true on average. Just as one example, in February of 2015, a study published in Science found that if you track the size of marine animals on average over the past 542 million years, they have increased 150-fold in size. Hmm. So why does this appear to happen? Well, I did find an interesting study on that. So there was a study in the American Naturalist in 2012 called Ecological Specialization in Fossil Mammals Explains Cope's Rule. And what this study think they find is that one possible way of explaining Cope's Rule is that evolution favors animals with bigger bodies. Like, if you're bigger, you're stronger and harder to kill, right? But the authors of this study looked at evidence from 554 extinct mammals over the past 60 million years. And they found a couple of interesting trends that got more specific than that. It's not just that bigger bodies are adaptive or that they're always better. These authors found that the increase in body size was correlated with, quote, increasing ecological specialization, meaning you're zeroing in on one more and more unique way of surviving in the ecology around you, with maybe a particular prey type or a particular hunting strategy or particular type of habitat that you're finally adapted to. As you get really good at one thing, on average, animals tend to get bigger. So the increase in body size was linked to that, but it was also linked to another interesting thing. periods of global cooling. And this tends to go in accordance with another informal biological principle known as Bergman's rule, which says that the colder a climate you live in, the more your body mass increases. So that's interesting. These bigger bodies tend to correlate with the world getting colder and with animals that tend to get more and more specialized and become less and less of a generalist survivor. But there's a downside that comes with this, right? Increased extinction risk when averaged over time. In other words, heavy lies the crown.
Ah.
So you want to be the king, the queen, the mob boss, the CEO. If you focus really hard on a very particular strategy for success, you might be able to make it, but you will be wearing a target on your back the whole time. Everybody wants to take you down. And in a metaphorical way, the same is true for a species. If you want to be the master of the sea, the megalodon, the leviathan, the king or the queen of the water, you will get crushed when your main food source disappears. It is hard to be a generalist when you're that big and that powerful and on the top of the pyramid.
Wow. You know, I'm tempted to make some comparison here between between the diets of apex predators such as this and humanity's dependency on fossil fuels, which, of course, ties in rather nicely with the history of whaling as well, the harvesting of these creatures for industrial purposes. You know, when you become dependent upon this one thing, what happens when that source shrivels up?
Yeah. And of course, this isn't going to be this true in the same way about all apex predators or all larger animals, right? This is something that appears to, based on this study, be true on average. So there are definitely going to be some predators that are more resilient and I think in most cases going to be more of a generalist survivalist than others. But the ones where their increase in size and food chain dominance correlates to this very direct specialization in a certain way of making a living, very often that does make you vulnerable. You lose your individualism as a survivor.
Yeah. Like one of the exceptions that comes to mind is, of course, the bear, particularly the larger bear species that are certainly large and ferocious and have no natural enemies beyond man.
Oh, think of the polar bear.
Yeah.
Polar bear, very powerful apex predator. Actually, though, it has a pretty particular ecological niche, though. Mm-hmm. And when, say, climate change happens, that does not work out well at all for the polar bear.
Right. But meanwhile, you also look at something like a black bear,
yeah,
which will eat just about anything, or grizzly bears that go through sort of varying stages of dietary consumption, but it's largely based on what is available.
Yeah, exactly. More generalist and thus a little bit more resilient, a little bit harder to go extinct.
Yeah, of course. Then you have the panda bear, which is certainly a specialist in its own right, and is therefore in a kind of fragile place as well.
It's true. If you're bamboo, you know, the panda bear is the most terrifying predator of all.
You know, I'm always astounded when I remember that the cave bear was probably an herbivore. You know, the ferocious bear that is depicted battling.
Oh, really?
Yeah, battling early man. Yeah, this would have been an herbivore. This would not have been out there actively trying to eat humans.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that.
Yeah, we could do a whole another episode on bears, basically, and there's plenty of content to discuss there.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I really enjoyed this look at apex predators because it's so counterintuitive to think of them as so evolutionarily fragile.
Yeah.
Yet again, not in every case, but so many of them.
Yeah, we tend to think, if you're the top predator, then you're the king of the hill. You are in a privileged position, and you're not susceptible to these various extinction threats. But you are still vulnerable.
Last thing I want to encourage today, look up the picture of the Leviathan's teeth.
Yes.
Oh, and sorry, I should say one more thing about its name. They had to, you know, again, earlier today we mentioned something about the weirdness of taxonomy.
Yeah, this was with the Basilosaurus.
Yeah.
That means King Lizard, even though it is a whale, but we can't change it because that was the first name.
The Leviathan whale, they had to change the spelling because I think there was already some other organism that had the Leviathan genus as spelled in English, Leviathan.
Oh, yeah.
So they changed it, I think, to the Hebrew spelling of Leviathan. So now it'd be like Leviathan.
Yeah, it has a Y in it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like if you were going to name your band Leviathan and then you realize there was already a Leviathan. So you just add some funny characters in there and you're good to go. Do a weird spelling on it. All right. So there you have it. If you would like to reach out to us about this episode, discuss some ancient apex predators, then we encourage you to do so. You can find us on social media. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on Instagram. But we highly recommend you check out stufftoblowyourmind.com because that is the mothership. That's our webpage. That's where you'll find all the podcast episodes, links out to those social media accounts, details on how you can contact us directly, and even send us physical mail if you so desire. And then, of course, there's the old-fashioned way to get in touch with us.
Right. That would be by email. Now, I want to mention, of course, a big shout-out to our excellent audio producers, Alex Williams and Tari Harrison. Thanks so much. And if you would like to email us, that email address is blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
Our kids have said to us since we moved to Minnesota, we are far more active than we've ever been anywhere else we've ever lived.
Moving to Minnesota opened up a lot of doors for us.
Just this overall sense of community, of values that, you know, Minnesotans have.
It's a real accepting, loving community, especially with two young kids.
See why CNBC ranks Minnesota number four best state to live and work. A great place to work, an even better place to live. ExploreMinnesota.com/live.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
We are the voice of NASCAR.
The green flag is in the air and we are underway. The Great American Race.
The Motor Racing Network. NASCAR Cup, Xfinity, and Craftsman Truck Series Racing. Live on your hometown radio station and MRN or NASCAR.com. Martinsville, Talladega, the Chicago Street Course. We have the side-by-side action and last lap passes for the win.
Photo finishes, Ryan Blaney will win.
The voice of NASCAR, the Motor Racing Network. Work.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.